In a sense, any sincere book about God is also Bhagavatam. But the book, but this particular Sanskrit work called the Bhagavatam is distinguished in many ways. In fact, when the Europeans came to India, that's a whole history we won't go into now, although it's very interesting. The English, the British East India Trading Company, the Dutch East India Trading Company, the French East India Trading Company. They came to India at a time when the Mughals were ruling, of course, and then as Mughal power waned for various reasons, they stepped in. Of course, the British were the big winners there in India. And actually, for a while, India was governed, India was ruled by a private corporation, which would probably please some of our political figures in this country. So India was ruled by a private corporation. Interestingly, they absolutely did not permit Christian preachers to come to India because it was bad business. They didn't, because their political control was somewhat, not shaky, but they were ruling a very large number of people, and there were all kinds of competing forces, so they're trying to be very careful about this. And it's just like, for example, let's say you open up a shop and you sell whatever, you know, pizza or hardware or whatever, and someone in your religion wants to come and preach out of your store. I don't think so, because we're trying to do business here. And so that was the attitude. They didn't allow preachers. But then what happened is that around 1800, in England, there was what was called then, it's also called the same in American history, a Great Awakening, sort of a surge of religious fervor, and we have to get back to God, and you know, we've strayed, and we have to, and so on. And what's that line from the Testament? All we like lambs have, like sheep have gone astray, each one to his own way. So there was this Great Awakening. And with this Great Awakening, there were political consequences. People started electing members to Parliament who were more, from the Christian right of England in 1800. And the British East India Trading Company, which ruled India, was under Parliament. And so this new Parliament changed the rules and said, well, preachers can go to India. And so they went to India, and then this really starts an amazing history for about 150 years where you have Western preachers trying to convert Indian people, and how the Western preachers are shocked by what they discover in India. Because the assumption they went on as they went around the world missionizing is that in these non-white countries and non-Christian countries, they were actually saving these poor heathens from barbarism and giving them the one true religion. The problem is when they got to India and started reading some of the literature, because in order to really preach well, they were quite conscientious and they learned Sanskrit again. They thought, in fact, they even stated this. This is actually stated in the historical record, that if we can translate the Bible into Sanskrit, it's kind of like the clueless Indians will just think it's sacred because, you know, whatever the Sanskrit they'll accept. And if we can translate their books into English and show how irrational they are, then that will further weaken the hold that this pagan tradition has on them. What happened is when they began to translate some of these Sanskrit books, they found an extremely sophisticated, theologically sophisticated monotheism. Which really shocked them. And what's interesting is that, anyway, we could speak, give a whole college course on this, but the point I want to get to here is that the book that most impressed them, the book that they identified as wielding the greatest cultural power on people in South Asia, and therefore the book which was translated so much more than other books, was the Bhagavatam. Of course, also the Bhagavad Gita, but the Bhagavatam, its genre is called Purana, which means ancient stories, ancient wisdom. Purana, and so there are 18 Mahapuranas, 18 great Puranas. It's a very large body of literature. But the Bhagavatam was translated into European languages many times more than all the other 17 Puranas put together. because they realized that this Bhagavad Purana was really at the heart of South Asian civilization. And the Bhagavatam, of course, is our main text, and it's the Bhagavatam which speaks so much about Krishna. In any case, that was just a little preface. And so before the hook comes and I'm pulled off this chair, I want to get to the topic, tonight's topic. So, there's a verse in the Bhagavatam which I want to quote on this topic of yoga relationships and different stages in the development of spiritual consciousness. So, there's a verse in the Bhagavatam that says, I'll quote the Sanskrit, Archayam eva haraye, pujam gaksha dhaye hate, natat bhakteshu chanyeshu, sabhakta prakrita smritam. Which means that a person who undertakes to worship the Lord, a person who undertakes to worship the Lord, but only in temple rituals, or actually here it's said archayam. Archa means like the deity form, to worship the deity. And in every religion, they may not have deities just like we do, but there's some type of divine. In Judaism, for example, the Torah is put in a tabernacle, and the most dramatic moment in the Jewish service is opening that sort of sacred cabinet and taking out the Torah. And of course, there are altars in all kinds of Christian churches in which different sacred objects and sacred rituals are engaged. So, and certainly, I mean, in Buddhism you find they have a long tradition of altars and rituals and icons and so on. So, in other words, I want to take this in a more universal way. This is not just a strictly ethnic particularity of India. So, the statement says, Archayam eva, one who undertakes to worship the Lord, but only in the temple, the mosque, the mandir, the synagogue, only in that ritual where one has a sacred object on an altar. And one does not worship or honor, puja, or it could mean worship or honor, one does not offer the same worship to the Lord, the same honor to the Lord, as he exists in the hearts of his servants, of those devoted to him, or as the Lord exists in every other living being. In other words, the idea here is that every living body is a temple. Every living body is a temple. A temple is a temple because God is there. Just like I said this morning that in the program we had, that if you read the Old Testament, you'll find that the first temple built in Jerusalem, it's stated over and over and over again in the Old Testament, it's a temple to the name of the Lord, so that the Lord lives in the temple as his name. So, the idea is, so the temple is where God lives, either in the form of his name, in the form of some type of visible icon or deity, in the form of, let's say, an invisible presence, in the form of sacred language, like a Torah, or mantras, or whatever. But in some form or other, a temple, a mandir, a synagogue, a mosque, and so on, is a place where God is somehow present. And so this verse says that one who undertakes to worship the Lord only in that sacred space, but does not recognize that every living body, not only humans, this is not anthropocentrism. This is not kind of like clueless humanism, thinking that, you know, we're the center of the universe. This is all life, all living beings, what has been called philosophically biocentrism. So if a person does not recognize that same divine, that same Lord, that same sacred, holy object you're worshiping in a particular building, that same Lord is present in every living body, then the devotee, the bhakta, or the devotee, it says, so bhakta prakriti smrita, is actually not on the spiritual plane, but rather is on the material plane. And of course, this trickles down into popular culture as the great spiritual religious dichotomy. And I saw there was a lecture to you going to give a lecture on that. And then there's a ton to say on that. But so as far as relationships, Jesus talks about this a lot. This is one of the points he. This was definitely one of his bullet points. Yeah. the fact that you've got to treat people right. That when, like when the Son of Man comes and separates people, I think it's the goats and the sheep, and each group will question the Son of Man, like, why are we going to heaven? Why are we going to hell? And the answer will be sort of mirror opposite answers for the group that's going up, because when I was hungry, you fed me. When I was lonely, you comforted me, and so on. And they'll say, we never met you before. And then he'll say, well, whatever you did to the lowest of my people, you did to me. And of course, the loser group is the opposite. You didn't feed me, you didn't comfort me. We never saw you before. Whatever you did to the lowest. So, and then Jesus, I think one of his most, for me, I think one of the most brilliant teachings, where he summarizes huge, massive of technical, ritual, and social and economic law in the Old Testament, that really boils down to loving God with all your heart, soul, and might, and loving your neighbor as yourself. And that's really what it's all about. And so, but there is this requirement that we cannot claim that we love God or we're serving God if we mistreat others. It's like you can't say to someone, you know, I'm your good buddy, and then you kick his kid in the face or something. Get out of here, kid. You know, I'm really your friend. You can't do that. You can't claim to be someone's friend and then mistreat their child. It doesn't work. I mean, it's just, I mean, who would accept that? God won't. So our relationships, and then of course you can ask, and by the word yoga, because that's in the title of today's lecture, so I don't want anyone, you know, demanding a refund or store credit, so. The word yoga in Sanskrit really means relationship. I mean, the word Sanskrit, the Sanskrit word yoga comes from the root yuge, Y-U-J. From which we, and because English is an Indo-European language, we still have words in English from this ancient Sanskrit root. Like, for example, conjugal, which means, you know, the most intimate connection, conjugal. Or the word yoke, to connect things, like to yoke things together, and so on. So yoga is that link, that connection. And the yoga of relationships is really just doing yoga right. Because the whole meaning of the word is that you have to connect. You have to connect with the absolute truth, and you have to connect with every other living being, because everyone's part of that ultimate truth. So, then how do you relate to people? As we know, some people seem to be specially sent to earth by God just to be annoying. It seems like that's their divine mission on earth. And as we know, some people use and abuse us. Some people, you know, may be dishonest with us, or may seek to exploit us, or, I mean, all kinds of things happen. So, we don't want to just be sentimental. We want to have a clear, firm understanding. What does it mean to love everyone? Even Jane Austen, you know, one of the great Krishna conscious figures in our line. There's a great line in one of her novels, Emma, where, I forget who, was Mr. Knightley or Emma, but someone has the realization that we should have goodwill for everyone. We should have goodwill toward everyone, but not everyone can be our intimate friend. Because friendship is based on reciprocation. If you are being honest with someone and they're being dishonest with you, it's not a match. And we should, I mean, we may love that soul as a soul, and we may seek the highest good for that soul. But in terms of someone who's really one of your supportive friends, because we all need friends, and we all need a circle of people that we can, you know, because we can't just live in isolation. So that's not a match for friendship, much less a match, let's say, for conjugal bliss. So how do we handle this? How do you love people and really wish them good at the same time, not just put a big kick me sign on you? Or not, you know, lend yourself like, hi, I love you, abuse me. Which is really not a life. So, Rupa Goswami talks about this in a work. Rupa Goswami is one of the great teachers of Krishna consciousness. He wrote about approximately 500 years ago. And I remember one time I went to give a lecture at Harvard before I actually went there as a graduate student. I was just invited to give a lecture there. And so before the program, I was speaking to the chairman of the Harvard's Sanskrit department, Sanskrit and Indian Studies, ancient department. And Gary Tutte, he started going on and on and on about how great Rupa Goswami was. He was just an intellectual giant of his time. He had such a powerful cultural influence. So Rupa Goswami is really one of the great figures in Indian intellectual history. And of course, he was a pure Vaishnav. He was a pure devotee of Krishna. But he wrote a book called I don't even call it a book. It's more like it's not even hardly a big pamphlet. It's just the Upadeshamrita, which means the nectar of instruction. In Indian culture, in Indian spiritual culture, it's very common to put amrita, which literally means immortal, at the end of a word, and so sort of means like nectar, because there's immortal nectar, or like something which is relishable and spiritual. So the nectar of instruction. And it's just, how many verses is it? 11? I think just 11 verses. So it's, of course, with commentaries it becomes a little book. But so one of the topics he covers in these very important 11 statements is, how do you relate to other people? It's one of the things he covers. And he makes a distinction, which is also found in other texts. The Bhagavatam actually makes the same distinction. And that is, let's say, false humility aside and political correctness aside, the facts are, some people in this world really are doing better than us, let's say spiritually. And some people are about the same level as us, and some people are not doing as well as we are. That's just, you know, it's just life. I mean, really, whoever you are, you can't say no one in the world is spiritually more advanced than me, and you can't say that no one in the world is doing as badly as I am. So he talks about three different kinds of relationships. And if we find someone that really seems to us to be spiritually more advanced than we are, someone we could learn from, then we should try to learn from that person. And try to offer service. As Krishna says in the Gita, it's a very famous verse in Bhagavad Gita, where Krishna says, Tad vidhi pranipatena pariprasnena seva, that to learn from an enlightened soul, one should submit for instruction. It's like if you go to college, let's say you're studying medicine or law or whatever, and if you don't believe a word the teacher says, and let's say it's actually a good teacher, then, you know, it's not going to go very far. So we should serve. There's like an exchange that where we offer service and then we receive knowledge. So if we find someone more advanced than us, then we try to please that more advanced person and gain knowledge. If we find someone about at our level, then we should seek friendship. So an appropriate object of our friendship is someone who is sincere as we are, someone who also wants to progress in life, also wants to uncover their real self and find God. And so someone who's about roughly the same position we are, that's a great person to make friendship with. And then if you find someone who needs help, needs a helping hand, is kind of not making it, or just, then we should be kind and generous to such a person. And so in a sense, I mean, of course, this holds true even in I would say even in mundane relationships, like let's say to have good friendship, to have a good romantic relationship. A lot of it is being objective enough. Being objective enough and realistic enough and smart enough to understand yourself, like, where am I really at? Because if I have an exaggerated sense of myself, then I will aspire beyond my real means, or I will envision myself in a position I'm not really at, and the world sort of won't buy it, or if they do buy it, it'll just create an illusion, and eventually the bubble pops, and you know, it's another scandal in the newspapers. Yeah, big religious leader, spiritual leader. So, on the other hand, if we don't have a realistic opinion of ourselves, we may reject friendship with someone who really is worthy to be our friend. Or we can also, I may think I'm too good for someone, but actually that person may really be a good friend for me. Or if my self-esteem is too low, which generally doesn't happen in California because they take self-esteem so seriously there. I'm in California, that I mean, so much so that I swear to Krishna, you can't use words anymore like junior high school. Why? Because it could affect someone's self-esteem. So junior high became middle school, and junior colleges, which is also, you know, sort of a malicious thing to tell someone you're going to a junior college. So they're now community colleges. But anyway, so let's say you're not from California and your self-esteem is not so great. Then I may actually, and I've met a lot of people like this, a lot of devotees like this, where I encourage them, like, you know so much, you should go teach, you should help people. And they say, well, you know, who am I? I'm really nothing spiritual. And I say, no. But the little test I give people is, I say, if everyone in the world was as spiritual as you, would the world be a better or worse place to live? If everyone in the world was as sincere as you are about spiritual things, would the world be a better place? And you know, almost in every case, the answer is yes, very much so. And that's, of course, Kant's, you know, the philosopher Kant's little test. Like whether, if you can universalize a principle, then it's valid. So if our self-esteem is too low, we may not teach people when actually we do have something to teach. We may feel unworthy of relationships that actually we could participate in and benefit from. And so having a realistic and accurate sense of our own spiritual situation and just our situation as human beings, and then being realistic about other people. Like, I mean, for example, let's say someone is looking for a relationship. You know, they're not happy alone. They want to be in a relationship. This happens, actually, sometimes. And so, let's say they meet someone. It could be a man meeting a girl meeting a guy, whatever. You meet someone, and let's say that person somehow strikes you as very attractive. Maybe a strong physical attraction or whatever. And so a strong physical attraction can lead one to sort of pretend you don't see, pretend to yourself you don't see that this person has character flaws. And because in a sense one is so anxious to close the deal and get their hands on this thing and, you know, sort of possess it, like get the title to this thing, that we may overlook things that we should not overlook. So really, there has to be in spiritual life and just in human life, one has to have the ability to really see oneself realistically, not to be unnecessarily hard on yourself, and not to be vain and narcissistic. It's almost like un-American, isn't it? Not to be vain and narcissistic. But anyway, it's almost treasonous, right, in this country. So. But if we have to be down to earth, we have to really see ourselves and then form friendships with appropriate people. We have to take help from the right people. We have to help people who are really worthy of being helped. And so when your life is filled with appropriate relationships that make sense, that are really good for you, then just in the course of living as in the world, you're constantly being nourished, and you're constantly being inspired, and spiritual life becomes very smooth and happy. So a lot of it depends actually on that ability to relate properly to other living beings. And of course, animals, birds, everything. We have an aviary here. Just as, let's say someone who is, has some developmental problems. Human being is, so it doesn't develop full normal human intelligence. I mean, you can't just go and shoot the person or eat them or something. It's, we don't do that nowadays. So, in the same way, actually, every living being is equally part of God. If you are a parent, if you're a mother or father, and let's say one of your kids got a higher SAT score, so like, I love you so much more than Bobby, because he got like a 490 verbal. I mean, you're like in the high 600s. I love you so much more. You're so much more important to me. I mean, who would think that was like great parenting? So God, or Krishna, from Krishna and God's point of view, a soul may be temporarily doing business as a duck, or just sort of a sidewalk slug, or as a human being, or whatever. But it's just like, for example, take a traffic light. Red, yellow, and green. Sounds almost childish. Take a traffic light, red, yellow, and green. The idea is that behind the red covering, the yellow and the green, it's all the same light. Light is light. But when the light is filtered through a red object, it's red light. Yellow, yellow light, green, green light. So, when consciousness is filtered through a baby body, it comes out as baby consciousness. When that same consciousness is filtered through a child's body, adolescent, adult, whatever, or filtered through a duck's body, or an orangutan's body, a female body, a male body, and so on. We feel like, let's say a person feels feminine consciousness, masculine consciousness, human consciousness, mammal consciousness, bird consciousness, just because the consciousness is being filtered through that covering. So self-realization means that you get behind the covering. And that's the whole point of yoga. If you know the Ashtanga yoga, the Eightfold Yoga, the first four steps, you know, yama, niyama, asana, pranayama, is really just a kind of, you know, this preparatory. Like you get prepped, you get in shape. It's like spring training or, you know, the exhibition season or something. You get in shape for the real yoga, which is meditation. But then step number five, once you've yama, niyama, you've kind of become a moral, decent person, you're at peace, you're serene, you're not doing crazy things like stealing from people or just, you know, you're just self-controlled and decent. And then you sit properly. And of course the asanas are necessary because yogis used to meditate for years and you can get a really bad cramp, you know, if you just sit down for years. So literally just to keep themselves from excruciating pain, they had to learn these asanas. And that was really the purpose of it. And then pranayama, control the breathing. Then, once you're sort of physically and morally in shape, the first four steps of the first four angas, or the first four parts of the Ashtanga Yoga, then it's pratyahara. Pratyahara is the fifth step. Now, prati in Sanskrit means like counter. It can mean a few things, but here it means like counter or back. And ahara means like, so it means like pulling back. Ahara, pulling back, taking back. And what it means is that normally our consciousness, its sort of natural vector, it wants to rush out through the senses to experience the world. And so when you pull the consciousness back, so it's not streaming out into the world, becoming attached to all kinds of objects, but rather it's you pull it back within yourself, that's called pratyahara. And then dharana, the sixth stage, the sixth anga of yoga, means that, you know, basically dharana means hold on. Because, you know, you pull it back and then it may want to pop, you know, you pull it back and you want to pop outside again. And so dharana literally, by the way, from the same root as the word dharma, but that's, you know, we talked about that earlier. So dharana, the sixth stage of yoga, means that you hold it. You pull your consciousness back and you hold it. And then dhyana. Then dhyana. Meditation. And finally samadhi, where your meditation becomes perfect. So, by the word, the Japanese sort of attempt to pronounce the Sanskrit word dhyana came out Zen. That's Zen, like Zen Buddhism. So, but getting back to this pratyahara, that's the whole point of this yoga meditation, is that you take consciousness, which always wants to run out there, and they even use this language in Sanskrit literature, like dhavatobahi, like running outside. You're supposed to do something inside, like, you know, practice piano or do your homework, whatever you're supposed to do. Instead, you run out to play outside. And so they use this imagery that to bring consciousness back so that you get behind all the coverings that are filtering your consciousness. So that you can experience yourself, you can know yourself, not through your body, like I'm a man, or I'm a woman, or I'm so many years old, or I'm this race, or that ethnicity, or so high, I weigh so much, which is not us at all, of course. The idea is pull your consciousness back so you find yourself as you really are, your unfiltered self, who you are. And also you find God. There's an ancient metaphor in the oldest Vedas that there are two birds in a tree. One of the birds is just witnessing, just watching the other bird. And the other bird is sort of voraciously trying to eat all the fruits of the tree. And so the witness bird is thinking, when will my companion turn and look at me and realize that their real happiness is in our relationship, not just trying to gorge himself on all the fruits. And so the witness bird is what is called Paramatma, the supreme soul, or the supreme self, or God. And the voracious bird that just wants to enjoy the fruits of the tree is, you know, yours truly and all of us. But that's the idea, to go within and to find yourself, and when you establish that relationship, enlightenment, the nature of enlightenment is, it's sort of like all or nothing. In other words, if you find yourself as a pure soul, then you see everyone else that way. You can't see yourself as a pure soul within and see someone else as just, well, that's just some guy with, or that's some girl. See someone else as their body. It's like when the sun rises. The sun illumines everything simultaneously. It's not the sun rises and, you know, this tree lights up, but that house doesn't. It all lights up together. And so if you really find yourself, you find everyone. And if you find others, you find yourself. And therefore, the ability to, how should I put it? We cannot love other people really more than we love God. We can't love God more than we love other people. It's like, you know, when Prabhupada, my teacher, first came to this country, he used to say that, I see all these billboards, he called them signboards, you know, Indian English, that I see all these signboards, they all say love, love, love. And he said, but it's not love. I mean, love means giving, not taking. And so, if I'm attached to someone, it means I want to take something from them. I want to enjoy that relationship. That's not love. That's just, I'm in business for myself, but I feel that it's in my self-interest to somehow possess this other person. Or to somehow or other get this person attached to me. It satisfies me. So, when we love someone with no possessiveness, like, I don't want anything. I actually don't want anything from you. I just love you. So if I can do anything which will actually benefit you, will make you happy, I'll be glad to do it. And what do I want in return? Nothing. Virtue is its own reward. In fact, when you get a relationship between two people who actually are not trying to take anything from each other, they just love each other. That's the perfect relationship. And so, every living being is part of God, Krishna. So again, you can't really love someone else more than you love God. Because if you don't love God, you don't know who the person is. You may just think they're a body, like you're really a cool body. No, No one is a body. Everyone is an eternal person. And so, if I see you as a soul, I see you as part of Krishna. It's like saying, I have absolutely no idea what America is, but I know perfectly what an American is. What does that mean? How can you perfectly understand an American as an American and know absolutely nothing about America? So, as every living being is part of God, how can I understand another person if I don't know God? And how can I claim to know God if I don't really understand other people? So we're all in this together. And that's why, just the last thing, because I know time is running out, and I don't want some time to get physical here, but the last point I want to make is, what I witnessed at American universities, I'm from Los Angeles, and for some time I lived very close to UCLA, and I used to go almost every day, take my morning walk there at UCLA. At least some parts of the campus are extraordinarily beautiful. Wouldn't recommend the engineering section, but anyway. So, UCLA is interesting because there is no majority group there in terms of like mostly white, mostly Chicano, mostly Asian American, mostly anything. It's really, there is no majority group. There's not even close to majority group. And they have these really nasty battles. Like for, I mean, things that are, mean so much in the world, like student body office. But anyway, they really did. I mean, so many, but in general, I mean, it's not just UCLA, it's American universities. I felt that the whole approach towards equality, in some ways, was very wrong-headed. Because it was like the balkanization. It was like the balkanization of the campus community. In the sense that you are, what are you? You are just really Filipino, or you're just Jewish, or you are Chicano, or you are, you know, or you're black, or you're Asian American. And everyone, like, dig into your race, dig into your ethnicity, and fight for your rights. It's everyone against everyone. And it seemed to me that what they should be doing is telling everybody, look it, none of us are these bodies. We are all absolutely equal because we're all spiritual beings. And it really does not matter what kind of body we have, because all that matters is that we see each other as we really are. We're all spiritual beings. We're all one. So rather than take the high road and say we are all equal, we are all one because we're all spiritual beings, it was like you get equality by every possible little bodily group fighting every other bodily group, and you know, it's just like everyone against everyone fighting in coalitions, and then you see the mess in America. So this is really important, this understanding of unity, of the oneness of every living being. Every living being is equal to every other living being in God's eyes, and in fact, ontologically, comes from the spiritual understanding. It will have tremendous social and political ramifications. It will change the world if enough people can understand this. So, the yoga of relationships. What time is it now?
6:30.
Oh, we have a few minutes?
Yeah, you can extend.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Get an extension.
Okay, I got an extension. Not a hair extension. So, any questions? Yes, please.
You said that you should help people, but you said if they're worthy of being helped. What's the distinction? How do you know that you should help someone?
Okay. You're sharp.
I am sharp. My last name is Lisa Sharp.
How did I know that? So, I suppose I meant something really simple, like, for example, someone wants to hear from us. As Jesus said, don't throw cast pearls before swine. So if someone is not going to, let's say if you open your heart and really try to help someone and they just ridicule what you say, or they take the help you give and they use it for some bad purpose.
Or what if they're abusive?
Exactly.
You Do you keep helping them?
Your first duty is actually to keep yourself healthy at every level, physically, emotionally, intellectually, spiritually. Because, you know, doctor, heal thyself. So our first duty really is to keep ourselves healthy at every level. And then let's say once we're fit like that, again, physically, emotionally, as far as possible, intellectually, spiritually, then we should do everything that's possible to help others. But not, but I don't think we should get into martyrdom. Because the world really needs teachers. And so yeah, keep yourself healthy first. And if a particular relationship is just not healthy for you, then of course, you know, you have to do what's right.
So somebody can say, after hearing you, that you shouldn't just see God in the temple, so now I'm just going to go out and see God everywhere.
Right.
And it's premature.
Well, some people sort of go the other extreme, and God is everywhere but the temple. So, for example, we should lead healthy lives, even in terms of body movement. Like you know, we know when you get out of bed, there's a good way to get out of bed, so you don't throw your back out, or you know, like the sleeping posture, or when you're walking. There's just, or what we eat during the day. They're just things you do all day to sort of keep your body in shape. When you go to a gym, or whatever, then that's a place where the facilities have been maximized so you can really get a workout. But then, of course, when you leave the gym, you have to keep it going. So a temple, or a church, or a synagogue, or a mosque, or mandir, or whatever, is a place where everything, the conditions, the environment has been maximized to help you to focus your consciousness and get a real spiritual boost. And then we take that out into the world, and we try to keep it going. It's like those old trolley cars which the Chevron Oil Company so wisely ripped up so everyone could buy a car and keep the air clean in Los Angeles. You know, I remember when I was a kid, they had these electric trolley cars, and like, it's like every you know, so often, like I said, at certain distances, regular intervals, they get a jolt of electricity that would keep the car going. And so it's like that. You know, regular spiritual practice, of course, your life is your practice everywhere you go. And yet we come to the temple or the church or the synagogue or the mosque. We go to these sacred places to get a boost, to get a jolt, to really get some energy, because it's a place where everything is completely focused, like a gym is completely focused on getting your body in shape. And a spiritual place should be completely set up and focused to get your soul in shape. So go for your workout, but then live a healthy spiritual life. Anything else? Well, thank you all very much.